I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today we'll be listening to the first half of an interview that I conducted with David L. Simon about opiates and intellectual property law. And it will not put you to sleep, even though both of those topics have that effect on some people. And you can listen to the second half of this interview at the IEET.org. Last week, I was sitting in the recording studio recording an interview with someone, and two guys walk into the studio as if they belonged here. And after I was done with my interview, I went and tracked them down and figured out that I had actually signed up for the recording studio the previous day, and that the fellow who was supposed to be in the recording studio at my time was named David L. Simon, a new participant in the WHUS family here at the radio station, and someone who is intending to start a public affairs talk radio kind of situation here at the station. He also turns out to be someone who is a perfect guest for Change Surfer Radio because he has practiced medicine for 11 years. He's an anesthesiologist. He just also graduated from law school with a JD and has many interesting experiences and orientations that we'll talk about in a second. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's not often that I get to have the sound quality of a guest in studio. Living, you know, being out here in the middle of nowhere in Eastern Quiet Corner, Connecticut, we don't actually get very many famous people that I can drag into the studio. So it's nice to actually have an in-studio guest. Now, David, you have a background in opiate pharmacology. And so let's talk about that for a second. One of the things that you studied as a law student is patent law, and we're going to talk about intellectual property law and your attitudes about it in a second. But tell us about this project that you've been working on of creating safer opiates and the kind of opiate pharmacology patents that you've filed.
Sure. As an anesthesiologist, basically I am familiar with opiate pharmacology. Anesthesiology is really the clinical practice of pharmacology, if you will. And one area of interest for me has been to try to formulate an improved opioid analgesic that will be less subject to abuse. As I'm sure you're well aware of, opiates can be abused, OxyContin being the one that's been in the news a lot about being abused, people becoming addicted to it. And there have been companies out there, biotech companies, trying to either formulate a new compound with less ability to make people high or euphoric. And there have been others who have tried combining a standard opiate, such as morphine or oxycodone, with another agent, the second agent blocking some of the euphoric effects. And that's what I'm interested in. I was fortunate enough some years ago to actually sell one of my patents to a pharmaceutical company that was working in this area, and now I'm working on another project with another compound to try to combine those, and I'm in the process of trying to get a patent. It's actually difficult to get a patent. It's not so easy, and if I can secure certain patent rights on this invention, then it would be my hope to try to commercialize this by licensing it to a biotech company.
And we have a long history of people making drugs to try to solve this problem. I understand that morphine was originally invented as a cure for opiate addiction, and then heroin, you know, came along, and then methadone. And so people have been trying to figure out how you can cure pain and do all the things that opiates are good at doing without making them addictive. What is the core of your strategy? Is it like time release? Is it because neurotransmitters are supposed to just leak into a brain and not hit them all at once? Is it to time release the dose?
Well, that's one strategy that people have used in the past. Studies have clearly shown that there's sort of a time sequence. The quicker that an opiate acts to the time when somebody takes it, the more likely it is to be abused. In other words, you take the pill, and if you feel good soon after taking it, that will sort of train the subject or the person to want to take it again, to feel good again.
Why coca leaf chewing addiction isn't as big a problem as cocaine snorting addiction.
That's right. That's right. That's not my strategy, however. There was actually a researcher in Albany Medical College that has developed a compound that is an alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic receptor blocker. And he developed this medication to treat various addictions, opiate addiction, amphetamine addiction. And basically what he's shown in animals is that if he gives this drug to animals that are addicted, then they don't get, they're less inclined to take the addictive drug in course of their addiction. So my idea was to combine this drug or an alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic receptor antagonist with an opiate in one formulation so that when you take the opiate, you get full opiate effects, but you don't get the effect of what is increased dopamine. What these scientists have shown is that dopamine is blocked. There are certain areas, well, we know that there are certain areas in the brain where dopamine is released, and the dopamine is the feel-good chemical in the brain. And my theory is that if you take one drug that has this alpha-3 beta-4 blocker in it, the dopamine response will be blocked, so you don't get the high, but you still get the full opiate effect.
So dopamine is the key to all addiction. I mean, gambling addiction, sex addiction, everything relates to somebody binding the memory of a particular experience with dopamine highs.
That's certainly one theory. That might be, I don't want to use the term simplistic.
Go ahead. Everybody else calls me simplistic. Simple-minded, even a fool.
But no. that's certainly one theory, and that's the basic theory, and that's the fundamental theory that most people work on. But there are probably an array of different receptors that work in concert with one another, and it's probably very complicated.
Okay, so the nicotinic part, does that have any implications for the use of nicotine in general? I mean,
yes, actually it does. Nicotine is actually one of the most addictive substances known. And again, there's this dopaminergic mechanism. You take the nicotine, you get a dopamine release, you feel good, and then you want to take some more nicotine. That's why cigarette smoking is such an addiction. So some of these drugs have been shown to be effective in treating nicotine addiction. But again, nobody's actually taken the drug and combined it with an opiate to try to stem the tide of opiate abuse so that the drug can be used to treat pain, but not be as likely to be abused.
There was a study that I was very impressed by where they took two different kinds of voles. Voles are these kind of insectile rodents, prairie rodents. They found that one kind of vole was monogamous and another kind wasn't, the males at any rate. And they found that the principal difference between them was a gene that regulated vasopressin. They tweaked the gene and they found that that modulated their monogamy behavior. And the theory behind it was that when the monogamous moles, when they had sex with a female vole, they would get this the dopamine rush from the sex, and they would have enough vasopressin in their brain to bind the memory of that particular female to that dopamine rush. And the non-monogamous voles would get the dopamine rush, but they wouldn't bind the memory to the particular female. So is that part of this strategy to break down, like, for instance, in this, what you're doing now, if I understand it correctly, by suppressing, by having an agonist for the nicotine, you're attempting to break down that connection between the drug and this dopamine rush, between the experience of the drug, taking the drug.
Right. And it's an alpha-3 beta-4 antagonist. So, you know, that certainly works as within that same theory. It doesn't necessarily address the vasopressin response to memory, which is very interesting. I hadn't heard that before, to be honest. But basically, it's sort of de-linking the opiate effects with the dopaminergic effects.
So, okay, so you filed patents on compounds that you hope will combine these effects together?
Correct. Actually, compounds and methods. It, again, gets a little bit complicated in the patent law, but there I have several patents pending towards methods of use of this combination and also the combination itself.
Okay. Let's, by the way, we're talking with David L. Simon, who is a MD and JD, MD in anesthesiology, JD, recent graduate, JD focusing on intellectual property law, aspirant, talk show host, which of course will be the ticket that he gets punched with. But, and also someone who has a personal interest in intellectual property law because he's filed a number of patents. Let's dilate for a second. I love that phrase, by the way. Quentin Young, who was a physician in Chicago when I was living in Chicago, he always had a radio show and always said dilate on his radio show. Let's dilate on that topic. Anyway, let's expand on that topic of patents and copyrights and go back. Why do we have intellectual property law? Who does it protect? What's its social purpose? And what's the difference between a patent and a copyright?
Well, the patent system and copyright system in the United States actually goes back to the Constitution. The founding fathers in Article 1, Section 8 actually wrote a clause protecting inventors and authors for their scientific workings and writings. And the theory behind it is that there's a trade-off. The inventor or author discloses certain information to the public upon which authors and scientists down the line can build upon. And in exchange for giving that information to the public, the scientist or author is given an exclusive right for some period of time where he can sell his product or writing exclusively or prevent others from using such works. So, you know, the theory behind it is that it creates and stimulates innovation. There's sort of an obvious aspect to that. I mean, if you give somebody exclusive use to something, it seems like they can make more money because they have a limited monopoly for a certain amount of time. And that's certainly true. And that's certainly a big incentive for investors to try to fund companies like biotech companies. But the other way that it benefits society is, again, disclosing information. In the United States right now, the laws were changed, I think about 1995 or 96, where even a patent application before a patent is accepted actually has to be publicly disclosed. Generally, it's 18 months after the patent application. That was to conform with other laws in other countries. The United States had it pretty good for a while because the law used to be that a patent is granted for 17 years after the patent is accepted. So if the patent was pending for 10 or 15 years, you could have a period of, let's say, 30 years of pendency and protection. And during that pendency period, it was a big secret. The rest of the world didn't know about it. And that was sort of an unfair advantage to the United States. And to sort of conform with other countries, the United States have now changed its laws. So basically,
well, when did other countries start paying attention to our patents?
Well, it's always been...
Or vice versa.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can't put an exact date on when that occurred, but certainly today there's a big negotiation worldwide going on amongst countries to sort of make the system as equal a playing field as can possibly be. There's a history where developing countries would sort of opt out of the patent system, and the developing countries would, you know, want to exercise their intellectual property rights.
Or exercise our intellectual property rights, depending on how you look at it.
Right.
Use our intellectual property without paying for it.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, there's an argument for that, right? I mean, if every Botswanan had to pay the full price for Microsoft Windows, then we can't imagine that they would have very many computers. And almost like a majority, I think, 60% of all software in the developing world or something outrageous like that is, in fact, copied software. Mm-hmm. So it could be a significant hamper on developing countries in general if they weren't ripping developed countries off, isn't it?
Well, that's sort of been a historic aspect of the argument. On the other hand, I think the counter argument is you let the law of supply and demand and the marketplace handle that. I mean, if Botswana can't pay for these large fees, and Microsoft wants to try to sell at lower fees, then maybe they get lower fees in that particular country. In theory, if it stays in that country and isn't pirated out and exported out to other countries at the low price, then Microsoft really doesn't lose because they're getting higher prices in the United States and lower prices in other countries that can't afford the higher prices. So the marketplace kind of handles the price of the particular intellectual property wherever it is. Of course, that's in theory.
Then you get situations like drug reimportation into the States from Canada,
right,
where they say, well, we're allowed to sell it to Canadians for half the price, but you're not allowed to buy it from Canadians at half the price.
Right. There's actually a first sale or exhaustion doctrine in the United States with patent laws, and it also applies to copyrights, where basically it says that once I sell you something that's patented and you buy it, well, you're sort of free to do whatever you want with it within the United States. Not all countries have that doctrine, however. If a drug originates in the United States, let's say a drug company in Connecticut makes a drug, sells it to somebody in the United States, and they sell it to a Canadian supplier, then that Canadian supplier should be able to sell it back in the United States under the exhaustion doctrine. If they sell directly first to Canada without selling it to someone in the United States first, then it's my understanding that that doctrine doesn't necessarily apply, which, you know, seems to go against the spirit, for instance, of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. That's, you know, supposed to open up the borders and allow free trade. But when it comes to pharmaceuticals, there seems to be a lot of pressure not to allow the free trade of the drugs across the border.
Now, when with both copyright and patent, we've had this debate about when it's okay for people to use and abrogate the rights that are protected under copyrights and patent. Under copyright, it's fair use doctrine, right?
Right.
And under patents, we had this whole different set of debates, like around pharmaceuticals, about when it's a humanitarian use or when you can have compulsory marketing. And we'll talk about that in a second. But so with copyrights, it's gotten pretty extreme. Like if you use three notes of a song, and it's a recognizable set of three notes, like the three notes that are the opening riff of some Led Zeppelin song or something, mm-hmm. and you sample that in a song, you have to pay for those three notes, even though, you know, they're just three notes.
Well, I'm not sure that that's the current state of the law. There was a famous case a while ago, Acuff Rose, where there was a rap group, and they took a song, trying to think the name of the song. It's an old Louis Armstrong song, I think, What a Wonderful Life. And they put it to a rap beat, and they used either the melody and or the words. And they were pretty blatant about it. And it was so blatant that even before it was released, the copyright holder knew about it, said don't do it, and they did it anyway. And the Supreme Court actually ruled that that was a fair use because it was a commentary, and it was a parody, and, you know, not all written material is subject to copyright because of the First Amendment that we have in this country. So
that's interesting. I'm glad to hear that. I hadn't heard about that case. I mean, there is this ongoing debate about what the limits of copyright and patent are in the patent domain. I mean, you're someone who's filing for patents, so
right.
you have a vested interest. But I know that you're an objective person, and so let's with the debate around antiretroviral drugs, there was this argument: look, people are dying. We can't wait for you to come out with a version of antiretroviral drugs that's cheap enough for people living on $1 a day to afford. We need to start getting these drugs to people in sub-Saharan Africa and Brazil and India, and those three governments in particular said, we're just going to start making them, and you're going to have to negotiate with us because we're going to make them if you don't negotiate with us. And eventually they got this negotiation that allowed limited compulsory marketing. They said, you can make it if you need to make it, but then you have to pay us something, and we have to have a negotiation about you paying us something. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the specifics of that particular case, but I do know the topic in general. And for instance, Burroughs Wellcome's in the United States sold AZT at what people thought was exorbitant prices. And the catch there was that a lot of the research to develop the ACT was through government-funded grants in the United States. And I believe it's U.S. Code Chapter 28, Article 1498, which actually allows the United States government to basically say, you know, take control of the patent and use it as they see fit. And the company whose patent would be used would then be entitled to seek monetary damages in terms of a royalty. There's also the Hatch-Waxman Act a while ago, which basically the Bayh-Dole Act some time ago, granted companies exclusive patent rights even if they used government grants. However, the government reserved the right to sort of license the patent if they thought that it was not being used fairly. To my knowledge, that's never been either statute's never been enacted. But the situation you described basically points out that the patent systems are, it goes by country to country. So the United States only has jurisdiction over the United States. The United States doesn't have jurisdiction of another country.
Well, there's the World Intellectual Property Organization that's trying to negotiate, you know, that everyone get on the same page.
That's correct. But one still has to obtain patents in different countries to enforce the patents. And the WPO is trying to sort of negotiate fair and equal access and rules and regulations among different countries, but one has to be a signatory, you know, to that, and then the laws in each individual country have to sort of support whatever agreement that would be, and that we haven't reached that state yet, and the developing countries don't have an incentive to, for the reasons that you just described.
We just sent a platoon of trade negotiators to mainland China to negotiate new trade arrangements. And apparently they got a real dressing down when they arrived from some woman politician who thinks the former mayor of Shanghai or Beijing someplace. And she basically said, you don't understand the way our economy works and you don't understand what it takes to sell to us. But one of the sticking points in the negotiations between us and China is that China has a lot of bootleg copying going on of right. Western intellectual property, and we want them to crack down before we're going to cut them slack on international trade. And they don't see it in their interest to do that, I guess.
Well, again, this goes back to the individual countries having their individual laws, and we're trying to negotiate things. China has been sort of notorious for piracy of computer programs and things like that, and entertainment, you know, videos, bootleg videos, CDs, music, things like that. And the companies in the United States, you know, emanating from Hollywood and places like that, obviously want to get royalties for these. But again, what's the incentive? So China, while it's a developing world power and certainly a very significant country with significant influence, in a lot of respects is still developing. And in some respects, it's an emerging superpower. In some respects, it's almost like a third world country. So again, we go back to that the dichotomy of, you know, the developed countries versus the developing countries and the different interests in protecting intellectual property.
I'm speaking with David L. Simon. He is an MD and a JD and former anesthesiologist, currently minted as a lawyer, future as yet to be determined, but also someone who's working on opiate patents. So let's go back to patentability for a second. If you were to discover that green tea, drinking green tea was the perfect thing for overcoming opiate addiction, mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to file a patent on green tea.
Not on the compound green tea, but you might be able to file a patent on the use of green tea to combat opiate addiction.
So even though it would be then everyone would know that drinking green tea is good for opiate addiction, if any doctor ever prescribed that their patient drink green tea, and you had the patent on the use of green tea as an opiate addiction treatment, you would be able to sue them for patent infringement.
Well, there are a couple of issues there. Probably the answer is no. One issue is that a patent, in order to be awarded in the United States, has to go through sort of a three-part test. One, the patent has to be non-obvious, which means that, you know, if everybody knows about it ahead of time, you know, it would be obvious and probably not patentable. The other thing, it has to be novel, which means new. So again, if it's already out there being used and other people have used it before this person applies for the patent, it fails the novelty test. In other words, it might be anticipated. And then finally, it has to have utility or it has to be useful. In this case, there is a use. It would cure opiate addiction, but it fails the other two tests. You have to meet all three tests to get a patent. So in that regard, depending on the circumstances and facts of that particular scenario, the patent may or may not pass muster. But in the United States, there was some legislation introduced a while ago that is colloquially known as the patent, the Medical Patent Act. And basically, this prevents patent holders from suing individual doctors for administering methods of therapy. But there is one exception, believe it or not, and that's for a drug. Again, because of the pharmaceutical interest being such a strong lobby in this country. So whether or not green tea was a drug or not could determine that situation. If green tea was not a drug, then probably the doctor would not be held liable for prescribing it. But if it was a drug, then maybe, maybe not.
That was the first half of an interview with David L. Simon. You can listen to the second half of the interview at the IEET website at ieet.org. And now a snippet of the song Body Hack by Tom Smith, who can be found at filkertom-itom.blogspot.com. And this is inspired by the Body Hack blog of Wired Magazine.
I got some eyebrow spikes and other implants. Some talons for my fingernails and feet. Telescoping bones, new skin with crimson tones. The scars across my back draw a Magritte. The catalog from Slashdot helped immensely. My eyes are different colors for each mood. I hear my own heart pound in 5.1 surround. As of next week, I'll no longer need food. I've got to change, but not how mother wants of me. I'll rearrange, it's just a body hack. It's not so strange, it's just like plastic surgery, taken to extremes, and all my hopes and dreams are looking in the mirror.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.